This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. In one typical day, the Cincinnati Children's Hospital Drug and Poison Center took 149 calls. That included 63 regarding children, 51 about adults, 33 from emergency rooms, 3 from law enforcement, and 4 regarding pets. Over 2 million poisonings are reported nationally each year, with 90% occurring in people's homes. The culprits, household cleaners, pesticides, and increasingly, liquid nicotine from e-cigarettes. We are joined now by the Cincinnati Drug and Poison Information Center Medical Director and Assistant Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine, Dr. Shan Yin. And to join our discussion, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Dr. Yin, welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Thank you for inviting me. It's my pleasure to be here.
Who works at the Drug and Poison Control Center? What kind of specialties do you need to have on board there?
So we have the main staff are what we call specialists in poison information, or SPI. We actually call them SPIs.
Okay.
The old name was Poison Information Specialists. That had a less fortunate kind of acronym. So ours are either nurses or pharmacists, and they have additional training kind of in poisoning. And we also have some nursing students, pharmacy students, EMTs. They work with us as well. They are called kind of poison information providers. They take kind of calls from homes. They don't take hospital calls. Only our SPIs are kind of allowed to take calls from hospitals where all of our PIPs are directly supervised by our SPIs. And then we have 3 board-certified medical toxicologists, myself being one of them. One of us is on call 365 days a year. So we back up our SPIs in case a case is more complicated than they are comfortable dealing with, or if a hospital physician has a case and they want to speak directly with one of the physician toxicologists.
Actually, we'll get to this document, but one of the things that your office provided as background information was a 24-hour log of the calls that came in, which I found totally fascinating. One of the things, though, specifically given what you're saying, I was amazed at how many calls you got from emergency rooms, from ERs. I guess I would have thought they would have known what to do in all of these situations, but you're a resource even for people with that level of expertise.
That's correct, yeah. I mean, I am also an emergency medicine physician, so I can speak for them. But we are like any other specialist. I mean, so the medical toxicologists have done a fellowship in toxicology. So just like an emergency medicine physician may consult a cardiologist or a gastroenterologist, we are here as a consulting service. They can consult us just because we do have additional expertise in poisonings.
But it was just insightful to me that it's really such a network out there of people who are working in any, you know, in the medical field
right,
to respond to people. Now, if you look at the typical home, what could be, this is a broad question
right,
on purpose, what could be considered a poison? What could end up being poisonous to somebody?
Well, there's an old saying from a 14th century toxicologist that the dose makes the poison, meaning that anything really in sufficient dose could be poisonous. So water, you could kill yourself. Now, it would take a lot of water to do it. But certainly some things are more dangerous in smaller doses. So household chemicals, particularly things like Drano, liquid plumber, those things are caustic. They can cause really severe burns if somebody drinks them. Mm-hmm. Prescription medicines, of course, are potentially could be dangerous. They are a number of medications in which a single pill could result in a fatality in a child if a child took them. So and other things, antifreeze is another common thing that's in the house that can be very dangerous. We have a lot of cases where people will take antifreeze or other chemicals out of containers that are child resistant and put them in other containers, for instance, Gatorade bottles, which are not child resistant. Oh. And children kind of think of these things that are to be, you know, that are okay to drink. And if you actually look at antifreeze, there's a dye in most of them that gives it a kind of a green color, can look very much like Gatorade. So we've had that scenario come up many times where people will take dangerous chemicals and put them in kind of bottles that are unmarked or not labeled as such.
So your admonition, don't take chemicals that are potentially poisonous and recognized from the beginning as potentially poisonous. Don't take them out of their original packaging so that the labels stay on there and there could be something right on the label that tells you this is poisonous. That I saw that in the literature and it was like I never thought about antifreeze and Gatorade. I mean, I can see where it could look
right
similar.
Yeah, not only the labeling but the child-resistant container. Those bottles container. Are designed so that children have a tougher time getting into them.
One of the other things was cosmetics can be poisonous.
Yeah, well, so if you look at what we get calls on for children, it's basically what's around the house. So, and there's the peak exposure rate is in children about 1 to 2. They're mobile, they're exploring, they don't have kind of the cognitive capacity to understand what's dangerous. And so they will get into whatever's around the house. So if you look at kind of the top substances that children get into that we get called about, cosmetics often is top. That doesn't necessarily mean that those are dangerous. In fact, most of them are very safe and most kids will do completely fine. Household stuff is often in the top five. Analgesics from a child perspective is in the top five because of acetaminophen, ibuprofen, children get fevers and parents have those things around. Mm-hmm. So most of the stuff that children get into is not that dangerous. And in fact, one of the primary benefits of the poison center is to keep people out of the emergency room. There was a study conducted by an independent group that for every dollar spent on poison centers, it was a savings of more than $13. Which was about $1.8 billion across the United States.
Because you can tell people quickly how dangerous this is and or what they should do in response to that.
That's correct, yeah. So there have been survey studies where they've asked people if the poison center wasn't around, what would you have done? Most people then would have either just called 911 or gone straight to the emergency department. There's also been some case studies where poison centers have closed. Louisiana closed and immediately they saw visits to the ER shoot up. And it only took them a couple years. They reopened the poison center because they saw that it just wasn't cost effective.
I have a 5.5-year-old granddaughter. So some of these examples really struck home. So one of them was on this 24-hour record that you sent out, a 4-year-old who ate 20 gummy vitamins. Now, these look like candy. They have bright colors. Supposed to be given one in the morning, I guess. It's a sort of a multivitamin. I can see where a child could say, well, one's good, 20's good, and I haven't had a green one today type of thing. Is something like that in that sort of dosage, you said doses are critical, is something like that, you get a call and said 20 gummy vitamins have been swallowed, is that dangerous?
So Fortunately not. Vitamins are in general very safe. The main problem we get into with vitamins are ones that contain iron. And a lot of the vitamin preparations, you know, I'm not going to say all of them, but a lot of the gummy ones I think probably don't contain iron. And generally for vitamins, you have to take a lot over many, many, many days. So a single kind of gorging of a bunch of vitamins usually would result in nothing serious.
So you would be able to tell a parent when they called in to watch for certain things but not have to run to the ER right away.
That's correct, yes. Okay. And we know that if the poison center didn't exist, that a lot of those people would just show up to the emergency department.
One of the most recent alerts has been about products that are related to e-cigarettes, particularly liquid nicotine. And my understanding is – I've never seen this. I don't have any idea about it. But they tend to be packaged in things that children may see as juice boxes, and this has become a problem.
Yeah. I think juice boxes, but packaging just designed to look very attractive to young people, children. And the liquid nicotine could be potentially very dangerous, so that if a child drank it, it could potentially result in a fatal case. And I think this is another instance kind of where the legislation, I think, was caught a little bit behind, where they could have, you know, instituted regulation in terms of, look, you can't put these things in packaging that is attractive to children. That's just not a good idea. They're not the market. So why would that be necessary? As well as ensuring that those kind of things do have child-resistant packaging.
Do you ever consult with companies about packaging and branding of items? I'm thinking of the problem that we face nationally and internationally, I guess, with the pods, the cleaning materials that look very bright and pretty colors and can look very attractive. Now, there's people doing really dumb things on purpose. I'm taking that out. But the question of trying to consult with companies and say, don't make them look so appealing to kids.
Yeah. So we have worked a little bit with Procter & Gamble in terms of just that, in terms of especially with the laundry pods and trying to, encourage kind of child-resistant packaging and other issues like that. That definitely would be kind of on an individual basis. And companies, for instance, iron, at one point, iron used to be a big killer of children, and then the FDA mandated that they had to be in blister packs, which are very hard to open, a lot of them. And we saw deaths in children fall basically to zero from iron. Well, the companies actually sued and said, you can't regulate our packaging. And now iron, once again, is back, kind of that you can get it in these big bottles without blister packaging. Now, again, companies can voluntarily say, we're going to do that. We're going to put our products in blister packs or what have you. But
that's a sort of policy
right
question that I think that's interesting. So what about another category that you get, not tons, but is pets? My pet has eaten something in the backyard that I'm not sure what it is, but he looks lethargic or whatever. You're open to getting calls from pets, not from pets, but about pets?
So I have no veterinary training at all. I'm overall responsible for all of the medical information that leaves our center. And I have no veterinary training whatsoever. I would not personally, and it would never come to me where there'd be a pet that has a problem, because I just don't know. Now, we do have resources on pet poisonings. While we can give out some information, we would encourage people to actually call. There is a pet poison center.
There is a pet poison
center. Yeah, there is. When confronted with those calls, we're happy to give out some information with the caveat that we are not experts. Things are very different, right? I mean,
right.
Chocolate and dogs, and right. Who would have thought? So with the caveat that we're not experts.
Just play that sentence out so people – you sort of – chocolate is dangerous for dogs.
Right, right, but not to people. So you can't – everything's not 100%. Because something's safe in a human doesn't mean it's safe in a dog and vice versa. So we then will give people information to either – you know, call their own vet or call the pet. There is a national pet poison center.
You know, in looking at this daily log, I just found fascinating. It seems like, and pairing this with the national statistics, there's a lot of calls about children because they get into things. I love the one where the three-year-old brother put fish food in his baby sister's milk and she drank it. What is that going to do? And, I mean, it's like I have no idea. Or the 17-month-old who ingested dog feces. What do you do about that? I can't imagine it, but there you go. But there's another aspect of these calls, and that's the adult calls. There were a huge number of attempted suicides. And I think that in our society, this is something we don't talk about, but it sure gets reflected here, of people who have intentionally tried to take their life with a variety of medicines and pairing medicines up and taking huge quantities, that you're seeing that it really is a significant issue here. And that's intentional, but it's very different than what children are doing. But I think it really says something about where we are.
Yeah, right. So, and we've actually seen an increase in adolescent calls about adolescents with intentional self-harm ingestions. So, yeah, that's a big part of what we do. And you know, with the adults, they're almost always there's a couple different categories. The intentional self-harm, as you said. There's occupation exposures, which we don't get a ton of. And then certainly there are the adults abusing drugs. But the intentional self-harm makes up a big part of it.
Have you gotten an increased number of calls because of the opioid epidemic that we're facing right now?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely we've seen an increase in the number of calls because of opiates. Now, although really that probably started somewhere even back around 2005-ish when that was – 2005 was the first year in the 35 to 44 age group that poisonings – there were more poisoning deaths than motor vehicle deaths in that age group. And then in around 2007 is poisonings became the leading cause of injury death in the United States over more motor vehicle accidents. Mm-hmm. And primarily a big part of that almost certainly is due to prescription opiates.
I want to get back to one thing. If you have young children in the house, what's your recommendation for what to do? How do you prepare for that?
So the most important thing is is preventing the initial exposure. So keeping medications in safe areas, up and away is one phrase that's been used. Keeping them in the original containers that have the package or the child resistant. Another fairly common scenario that we see are the grandparents or other people have what's called pill minders. So they have the whole week's worth of medication set up, and most of those don't have child-resistant containers. So you've taken medication out of a child-resistant container and put it into one that isn't, And you also have an entire week's worth of medication, often with multiple medications. So kind of preventing that initial exposure should be the number one thing.
That's a really good point about the pill minder. Thank you. Well, I want to thank Dr. Shan Yin of the Cincinnati Drug and Poison Information Center for being with us today. Telephone numbers are on our website, both the local and the national Poison Center. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our programs are available on the website WVXU.org. I'm Dan Hurley. Stay tuned to 91.7 for Here and Now, coming up next.